So, welcome back again. Now we can continue the next sutta, one sutta after the other. And the next one is called the Shorter Sutta on the Simile of the Elephant's Footprint. And this particular sutta is quite famous in many ways because this was one of the suttas that was taught by Venerable Mahinda, who was the son of Ashoka. He is the one who went to Sri Lanka, right, and converted Sri Lanka to Buddhism. And this is one of the suttas that he taught when he went to Sri Lanka, and he was very successful. So this is one of the reasons why the sutta is so famous. And this is one of those interesting questions which we talked about a little bit before, is which suttas are the most important ones? Is it possible to make a hierarchy of what is important? And of course, one of the things that we saw in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta is that the things that the Buddha himself emphasized was the 37 Bodhipakya Dhammas, right? The 37 aids to awakening, the Noble Eightfold Path, the seven factors of awakening, and all of that. So what about, apart from that, how can we kind of make a distinction between those teachings that are important and not important? And one way of doing that is to look at those teachings that the Buddha repeats again and again, right? The things that you see in all the different Nikayas, you see it in slightly different frameworks given to different types of people. And of course, those teachings that you see that are core in that sense, they are going to be very important. Whereas teachings that are one-off here and there are obviously much less important because the Buddha didn't emphasize those teachings in the same way. And this particular sutta, which is often known as the gradual training. You start off at the very beginning of the training, going all the way to the end, showing all the steps in between. This is one of those suttas, again, as you see pretty much everywhere. There is about 12 versions of the sutta in the Digha Nikaya. There's another 10 versions of it in the Majjhima Nikaya. You find a version in the Anguttara Nikaya, so it's everywhere. And this is one way of deciding that this is a kind of a core teaching. Another way of deciding that is that it is really just an expansion of the Noble Eightfold Path. This is So it's kind of pulling that out and showing that in detail how the Noble Eightfold Path actually works. And this is another reason why it is core, because it is really part of these 37 Bodhipakya Dhammas that we looked at in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta. So this is one of the reasons why I find this teaching very inspiring, and very inspiring because it shows the whole path, it shows it in great detail and all of these things. You will find yourself somewhere on this path, so it's really something that is relevant to everybody. And it is usually the kind of the sutta that I use as a foundation for almost all these retreats that I teach. Because it is so practical and it really gets down to what we have to do on the Buddhist path. So that is this shorter sutta on the simile of the elephant's footprint. As always, this is just an extract. I haven't actually given you the whole sutta here because the whole sutta is very long. But this is the core part of it, that aspect which has to do directly with what to do. Who is the donor for this one? Oh, there. Okay. Great. That's very, very kind. Okay. Let us just start. Let's just see what happens when we get into the sutta and see what it has to say. And before this, there's a long section where the Buddha makes it clear. First of all, there is a Brahmin who has been to the Buddha, and then he meets another Brahmin on the road back when he's on the way back from the Buddha, and then they have a chat, and this Brahmin says, "Oh, the Buddha is so magnificent, so amazing, so wonderful." When he has a debate with somebody, he always wins the debate, and the people, they come to convert the Buddha, but they end up being converted themselves, that kind of thing, right? It's quite sweet, actually, quite nice. And then this Brahmin disciple, well, I've got to see the Buddha too then, because if he's that amazing and marvelous, I want to see him as well. So he goes to the Buddha, and the Buddha says, that's not the reason why the Buddha is marvelous. I will teach you another teaching, and this is the simile of the elephant's footprint. And he says, it's just like when you go into the forest and you want to find a large elephant, you look for the footprint. And when you see a large footprint, then that's when you start to think, oh, maybe I have found a really large bull elephant, because this is the kind of footprint they make, right? Then he follows after this large footprint, and he sees other signs, he sees markings on the trees where the elephant has been kind of scraping the trees and these kind of things. But still, even though he sees all those things which look like it is a large bull elephant, he does not come to the conclusion until he goes all the way and actually sees that elephant with his own eyes. Only then does he come to the final conclusion. This is indeed a large bull elephant. And this sutta is similar to that. It talks about all these things that we do on the path, but we don't come to the conclusion that it is a large bull elephant until you actually see the Dhamma for yourself. But some of the things that are the footprints of the Buddha, right? The footprints of the elephant start when you come to the jhana stage, the jhana and the insight stages, when you recall the past lives, these kind of things. That's when you see the footstep of the Buddha. The Buddha has been here, right? That's when you start to feel, oh, this is getting very exciting, very, very close to the Buddha. And this is what the sutta is about. So this is the simile of the elephant's footprint, how we follow after the Buddha, and eventually we see the Buddha with our own eyes. So now the Buddha explains this way to see the Buddha, how we actually do that, how we follow after the Buddha in this way. So he says here, so too, Brahmin, here a Tathagata appears in the world, accomplished, fully awakened, perfect in insight or true knowledge and conduct, sublime, knower of the worlds, incomparable leader of persons to be tamed, teachers of gods and humans, awakened, blessed. So that is the very beginning of this gradual training. This is how the gradual training actually starts. So what is interesting here is that the gradual training starts when the Tathagata appears in the world, right? This is actually how it begins. It doesn't begin with what you do or how you practice or anything like that. It begins with the idea of a Tathagata arising in the world. Tathagata, of course, being the Buddha, somebody who has insight into things. Without that Buddha, without somebody actually seeing these things, there is no gradual training. There is no Noble Eightfold Path. There is no Four Noble Truths. Somebody actually has to penetrate and see these things before it actually happens. And of course, that's very interesting. It means that when there is no Buddha around, then there is no practice, really. There is no practice that leads you to this goal, because you have to have those teachings to actually be able to get anywhere. And this is a very important point, I think. Very often in Theravada Buddhism and other kinds of Buddhism as well, we talk about the Bodhisattva path and these kind of things. But from an early Buddhist point of view, actually, there isn't really any path until the Buddha arises in the world. Prior to that, there is just darkness. You don't know where you go. And we saw that with the Buddha previously. We talked a little bit about this before, that when the Buddha was a Bodhisattva, he had wrong view and he had defilements and he was trying to find his way. And when he met the Buddha in a past life, he dismissed him as some kind of shaveling ascetic, right? Didn't want to have anything to do with him. And then in this life, he practices all the ascetic practices, which are the wrong way, right? So there is no indication there that the Buddha is following a path. There is no, this idea of a Bodhisattva path actually is completely missing in the early suttas. The path only arises when a Buddha arises in the world. So this is actually, I think, a very important point from the early Buddhist texts, something that people often don't see, perhaps, in these texts. So what does it mean that the Buddha arises in the world? It sounds a bit mysterious. The Buddha arises in the world, like they appear out of nowhere or something like that. Buddha arises in the world. But the idea here, of course, is just that occasionally there will be a person, someone in the world who has very strong spiritual faculties, right? Because of their past actions, whatever it is, they happen to have these strong spiritual faculties. And this is not because they have developed them specifically. It is only because, more or less, by accident, they happen to, this doesn't happen by accident, of course, because it happens because of causes and conditions, but not causes and conditions that are developed in any systematic way. They just happen to come together more or less randomly because for whatever reason that actually is. So when somebody has the right faculties together, they grow up in a spiritual environment like ancient India, where there were people already practicing samadhi, where there were people supporting spiritual practitioners. All of these factors somehow come together, right? And then this person arises. Then that is when somebody makes a breakthrough to seeing things according to reality. So this is what it means, like a Buddha arising in the world. It means that somebody, some person somewhere, just happens to get the right qualities together. They have the insight, and then they become the Buddha as a consequence. It's a completely natural occurrence. I like to say that the Buddha is a natural phenomenon, right? We are all natural phenomena. So, because we arise according to causes and conditions, there's nothing kind of special about it. The Buddha, too, is a natural phenomenon. When things come together in a certain way, a Buddha becomes possible. Yeah? So, and this is why, because it is a natural phenomenon, what that means is that every now and again in human history, in the history of the universe, if you like, there will be somebody. The conditions will come together in such a way that somebody will become a Buddha. And that's why we have this idea in Buddhism of different Buddhas, right? Buddhas in the past, Buddhas in the future, Buddhas now. Because it just has to happen every now and again that somebody actually makes that breakthrough and sees things according to reality. There is, we had a look at the Mahaparinibbana Sutta before, and in that sutta, Venerable Sariputta talks about past Buddhas and future Buddhas and the present Buddha. He doesn't name these Buddhas, there's no need to name them. This is just a natural principle that these things will happen every now and again. So this is the beginning of the path, right? When somebody makes that breakthrough and is able to see things according to reality. There's something very nice about this, that a Buddha doesn't just happen once, but it happens at regular intervals. And what is nice about that, it doesn't make us all that special. If there is like one savior, the savior has arisen in the world for our benefit, is the only one, right? And if you happen to be in the right place at the right time, then you will be saved by the savior. Otherwise, there is no kind of hope. It's one event that happens once in humanity. Then it kind of makes us feel very special, right? Oh yeah, we are around just when the savior is around. But actually, in Buddhism, there is no such special event or special thing. These are things that come and go according to patterns, right? According to certain regularities. It makes us less important. Right? Is that nice? Good to be less important? I think it's quite good to be less important. It's good to be just ordinary, right? We don't have to be special. If we see ourselves just as another person in the world, another ordinary person, that's good. That sounds about right. If you recall your past lives, right, and you think that you were Cleopatra or King so-and-so, right, it's very unlikely to be true, because how many people can be queens and kings and that sort of thing? If you were like an ordinary peasant, a farmer, working really hard, sweating, having lots of problems, having a really difficult life, that is the kind of past life memory that I believe in, right? This is the thing you can expect, because that's what most people are like. And we are, most of us, we are just ordinary people, and this is how things tend to work out. So, of course, then when the Buddha arises, then what really arises at that point is right view. Somebody makes that breakthrough, sees things according to reality, right view becomes available in the world. prior to that, we're all walking around in darkness, trying to kind of find happiness and avoid suffering. That's the only thing we know as human beings. We don't want to suffer. We want to be happy. We know that much, right? But apart from that, we don't really know where and how to find that. So the Buddha is often called the eye of the world, right? Because he sees for everyone else. And when the Buddha sees, then he has that ability to pass on that information, that vision that he has had, to pass it on to other people. That's why he's called the eye of the world. I like that. He's the one who sees first and then passes it on. And of course, from that, everything else then comes, right? Then, of course, the whole teaching and everything happens from that. So that is the idea of the Tathagata, the Buddha arising in the world. The Tathagata, the word, is the word that the Buddha uses to describe himself, and it's a slightly mysterious term. It means something like the one who has come thus or gone thus, or the one who has arrived at truth is another possibility. So it has a kind of slightly mysterious feel. And I think that's kind of the idea behind that word, that it is, here is somebody who is special. It doesn't really matter so much exactly what the word means. It means the Buddha, essentially. So then, having looked at those few words, then we have this long description coming afterwards. And this is a description of the Buddha. And some of you probably know that this is the Itipiso Bhagava Arahang Samma Sambuddho Vijja Charana Sampanno, etc., right? So that is the formula that we often chant when we chant the homage to the Buddha. And this, of course, is sometimes people do this chant and they don't know whether it comes from the sutta or where it comes from. But this Itipiso chant comes directly from the suttas. And, of course, the important point of this Itipiso chant is that when the Buddha talks about how he would like people to remember him, how he would like people to think about him, how it is that we should recall the Buddha when we do the Buddha Nusati, this is what he has to say. This is how we should recall the Buddha, right? So this is quite important. It's important to kind of get this right, so we think about the Buddha in the right way here. And one of the things that the Buddha Nusati does when we practice the recollection of the Buddha in the right way, one of the things that it can do for us, it can give us a sense of joy, a sense of happiness. Wow, there is such a being in the world, right? What an amazing thing it is that there is somebody who understands all this stuff, like the supreme teacher who can teach us the highest happiness. It's wonderful how lucky I am to be around, right, when this is actually happening. And the idea is to lift you up and give you a sense of joy. And that sense of joy that you get from thinking about the Buddha in the right way, that becomes the foundation sometimes for your meditation practice. As I was saying on the very first day, happiness and joy is such an important part of Buddhist meditation, right? And one of the things the Buddha does in the suttas in so many places is to show us how to give rise to that happiness and joy as a basis for meditation practice itself. And this is one of those ways of doing that, recalling the Buddha in the right way. So it is significant. This is important, right? This matters. Get this right, and it may actually help you in your meditation practice. Don't get it right, and perhaps it may even be negative or detract. Of course, for the noble ones, this is very easy to do, because for the noble ones, you know what the Buddha is. You have discovered the same truth yourself. So you will be very happy whenever you think about the Buddha. But for the rest of us, we have a little bit of idea who the Buddha was, but not a very strong and clear idea. So because of that, we need to work a little bit on this to be able to get a feeling for the Buddha. So this is the formula, and before I look at it in detail, I want to point out a few things that are not found in this formula, because this is perhaps just as important as what is found in there, right? And one thing that is not found there, I've just read it out before, is nothing there about supernormal powers. That doesn't say that the Buddha flies through the air and teaches all the day. Well, it actually says it teaches the day, but that's it does say that further down. But it doesn't say much about supernova. He reads your mind and he kind of does all of this kind of stuff. It is not there. And yet, very often, of course, in popular Buddhism, these are the kind of things that we think about when we think about the Buddha, someone with enormous powers that can do all kind of miraculous things. And, of course, as I was saying the other day, the Buddha tends to downplay all the psychic phenomena. He tends to say that he actually is slightly disgusted. Actually, he actually used the word disgusted. Jiguchi is the Pali word. Jiguchi means literally disgusted. He's disgusted with his psychic powers. That's what he says. So you should not expect him to talk about these things, right? When he talks about himself. And of course, he does not talk about these things. This is not what the Buddha is about, psychic powers and that kind of thing. So that is the first thing that is missing from that formula. The other thing that is missing is anything about bodhisattvas, right? That he is special in any way, that he has practiced for a long period of time. There's nothing in there about that either. Nothing about this thing which becomes so important in later Buddhism, bodhisattva ideal, Jataka stories, the past of the Buddha, and all of that is actually also missing from here. So, these things are not there. And what is there instead is actually, therefore, is actually quite interesting here. So this is how the Buddha would wants us to reflect on him so that we get maximum benefit out of thinking about the Buddha. So let's have a look at these things. The first one is that he is accomplished. And the word, Pali word for accomplished is arahant, right? Arahang Samma Sambuddha, if you know that chant. And accomplished here really just means that you are perfected, you have reached a higher stage of perfection in Buddhism. That's what the arahant is. I translate arahant these days as the perfected one, because I think that gives a good feeling for what it means to be an arahant. And of course, the word arahant, it has a beautiful meaning. It means that you are worthy. Arahati is the Pali word. It means to be worthy. So it is the worthy one. What is he worthy of? And of course, he is worthy of a number of things, but one of the things that he is worthy of is, of course, generosity, the support of other people. Because here is just like any teacher. When you have a teacher and you have respect for the teacher, they are worthy in a certain way, worthy of your support, worthy of maybe paying them a salary, worthy of whatever. In the same way, the Buddha, being the highest kind of teacher, is worthy of our support, right? Worthy of generosity. It says elsewhere, it says worthy of generosity, of Anjali Karani, of homage, of Dakineya, and all of that. So basically of support, essentially, that's what it comes down to. And of course, he's also worthy of our respect, right? Anyone who is able to give you something very profound and beautiful and powerful, even an ordinary teacher, we say, is worthy of respect, because an ordinary teacher gives us something that is useful for us, that we can use in our life to make a living and all of these kind of things. But when somebody gives you the highest thing you can possibly have, the highest kind of happiness or whatever, they become the most worthy for that reason. So this is the worthy one, the arahant. Fully enlightened, Samma Sambuddho. Full awakening, full enlightenment. What is the idea behind that? And of course, the idea behind that is essentially we can look at full enlightenment from many different perspectives. But one of the I think important perspectives, of course, that you are fully enlightened is that you understand the world in a certain way. You have seen the world according to reality. This is what awakening really means. And of course, when you see things according to reality, you can act according to the reality. If you are blinded by the way things actually are, you don't see things the way they are, you cannot act on that information because it is biased, it is deluded. Once you see things according to reality, you can make good decisions in your life. And this is very obvious that that is the case. If you think that something is right when it's not, and you act upon that, you're going to make stupid decisions. If you need to go down to the shop to buy something, and you go in the wrong direction, you're not going to get the shop. You're not going to get what you want, right? And this is the problem with life. We don't usually get what we want because we're missing the full awakening here. This is what the Buddha is, that insight into the way things are. So it enables us to pursue those things we really want, which of course is happiness, contentment, in a much deeper sense than we ordinarily are. Full awakening also means an ending of the defilements, right? Complete purity of the mind. That's also what it means. And of course it means an ending of suffering itself for the person who is fully awakened. So that, of course, is part and parcel of that as well. So these are, you can see, all of this full awakening here is always about things that have a very tangible result in our life, things that are meaningful for our lives, not just kind of entertainment value like flying through the air, but things that actually are meaningful in a profound sense. And that is what full enlightenment really is. You know, even if you saw somebody flying through the air or walking into a mountain, you would say, wow. But then you would think, afterwards you would think, so what? Okay, I've seen this, now what? Is this really going to be all that helpful for me? And of course it isn't. It may give you a little bit of faith and confidence and support you in a little bit in a way, but it's actually the teachings that actually matter. These other things are more like a fancy kind of entertainment almost. Okay, so full awakening, full enlightenment. Then we come into the things that I think are more important, and this is perfect in true knowledge and conduct. And true knowledge here is vidya. We have just seen what avidya is before. Avidya is delusion, and this is the opposite, which I would call insight very often, true knowledge, the vidya. And in the suttas, the vidya is usually divided up into three specific types. And this is taken from the Brahmanical tradition. The ancient Hindu tradition also had three vidyas, and the Buddha uses the same framework in his teachings. Of course, he says that the vidya of the Brahmins, they're not the real vidya, they're not real insights, but these are the real insights that actually make a difference in the world. And you know, of course, what those three vidyas are presumed already is insight into past lives, right? I was talking about this before, the seeing of how people are reborn according to karma, and then the destruction of the asavas, the insight into the three noble truths, I was going to say that, but four noble truths as the last one. So this is what real insight is like. And this, I think, is a very interesting point, is that the idea of seeing your past life, this is insight. This is understanding. This is the opening of the eyes to the nature of reality. This is an extraordinarily important thing. That's why it is part of these te vidyas. Yeah, because it is so important. And it's the way it is explained in the suttas, what happens when you have these kind of insights, or the Buddha has these kind of insights. The Buddha talks about his own awakening experience, and he says the awakening experience, he uses two different similes to explain this. One, he says, is like somebody turning on the light. Right before, I was in darkness, andhakara, making you blind. You don't know what you're doing. You are in darkness. And then the light gets turned on and you can see what you're doing. If you are in darkness, you don't know where you're going, right? Even if you know that you're supposed to, say, go to in a certain direction, you're supposed to go towards that big tree. If you can't see the big tree, you can't go there. And when somebody turns on the light, now you know where you have to go. Now you can see the dangers, you can see the direct way, what actually is the right thing to do. So this is a very important simile, a metaphor for wisdom and for understanding in the suttas, the idea of light being turned on. We talk about lighting a candle, right, so we can see in the dark. It's the same kind of thing here. The other simile, which is very powerful here, which the Buddha uses about his own life. He says it's like a chick, a small chicken inside the egg, right? A chick inside the egg. And he says it's like breaking out of the eggshell. Right when you see your past life, it is like you're coming out of the eggshell. And when you think about that, the idea of coming out of the eggshell, it is a massive transformation for that little chick. When you are inside the eggshell, you can't see anything. All you can see is the eggshell right in front of your eyes. The world seems so small. The world seems so confined. There's nothing much to see about it. And one day, you use your little claws, you use your little beak, and you make a hole in that eggshell, and eventually you come out. Wow, this is what the world is really like, right? It is so different from what it looked like. It is so enormous. There are so many colors. There are so many shapes. There are so many people. There's so many other chicken around, running around, right? There's so much action, so many things happening in this world. This is what the world is like. And this is exactly the metaphor the Buddha uses for saying, understanding the reality of rebirth. We are trapped into this little reality here and now. We see this one little life which begins at birth and ends at death. And that is all we see. And because that's all we see, we put all our energy, all our effort, all our resources into making that life kind of really, really nice. But because we have no idea of reality, we don't invest our time and resources into this bigger picture that you see when you break out of that metaphorical eggshell. And wow, this is what it really is like. It changes your entire viewpoint, your entire outlook, your entire understanding of the world is completely changed once you understand the idea of rebirth. This is such, and this is kind of the simile that the Buddha uses for this. This is why these things are called real insights, because they change your entire outlook, the entire aim, the purpose of life. Everything changes as a consequence of these kind of things. That is the first thing about the te vidya, the real knowledge of these things. The second one is the idea that people or beings are reborn according to the karma, according to their actions. And that means that there is a system to rebirth. Rebirth is not random. It happens according to certain natural laws. And these natural laws are called karma, right? Karma and karma vipaka is what these natural laws are about. So that is the other thing, to understand these natural laws. And of course, the point about natural laws is that they are impersonal. In one life, you make bad karma because you have been influenced in a bad way. The next life, you make good karma because you have been influenced in a good way. So it's all about, it's all impersonal. It all happens according to cause and conditions. And then you see that as you break out of the eggshell. This is how it works. This is why I'm making bad karma. This is why I'm making good karma. Now I get reborn in a good place, now in a bad place, now somewhere in the middle. I don't really want to keep on going like this, up and down like some kind of yo-yo, bouncing back and forth, right, between these various locations. I've had enough of that. And you start to see how this whole thing functions and works. And you start to get a kind of feeling of repulsion. You feel repelled by this. This is just so scary. Also, one of the things that you see when you, of course, break out of that eggshell and you see rebirth, one of the things that you see is you start to see how, in the past, how you have been reborn into all of these different locations. Sometimes maybe you stay in the human realm for a very, very long time. And when you see that you have been doing the same stupid things, life after life after life. Imagine, I don't know about you, but I don't know how you feel about this, but if you think about your own life, would you be happy to go through exactly the same life again? That'd be good, right? The same problems, the same growing up, having all the problems there is when you grow up, going to school, doing all of those things, right? Getting an education. After you've done that a few times, it's enough, right? Whoa, I've done this already, and maybe you remember 10 lives. Oh, 10 lives already too much. But when you've done this maybe 1,000 times, and you don't really learn anything, you kind of start from scratch every time, and you do the same silly mistakes, the same things. And then you become a Buddhist, so you have a few really nice lives, you can become Buddhist. Then you forget about Buddhism, because Buddha disappears, Buddhism goes down the drain, right? You become a Christian for a while, and a Muslim for a while, then you're an atheist for a while, right? After a while you think, no, enough of all this. Then you become a Buddhist again. Okay, now you are a Buddhist, right? Now is your opportunity not to get out of this, not to fall into the same problem again. And this is what you see here. when you look into the past. This is the horror of it. You understand that you're not really going anywhere. Just going round and round and round and round, doing the same things. Enough, enough, please allow me to come off this wheel. Then you hear about the Buddha's teaching and you understand now the opportunity is there. This is a very important thing. Maybe I'll talk a bit more about this later on, because this is the kind of thing that some people who have recalled their past lives and have this kind of experience, that is what they see, right? They see, oh, this is actually quite bad. I really have to get off this. And this is kind of the feeling you have. So this is why insight is so important. It is so hard to gather this from our ordinary life. It's so hard to understand really what this is all about just by looking at our ordinary existence here and now. You need this bigger perspective to understand what's going on. And then you have the final insight. The final insight is the destruction of the asavas itself, the seeing of the Four Noble Truths, the understanding that rebirth has come to an end, right? By having direct insight into those things. And that is the main understanding that you have when you become an arahant or become a Buddha. The main understanding is that insight, is that now rebirth has come to an end. There's no more of this messing around. No more of all this suffering round and around and around. Now I've made an end of all of this. So these are the three real insights according to Buddhist teachings. Very interesting, right? Because it is not normally how we think about insight, but this actually, I think, comes the closest to what we call about three real insights. Why? Because they are incredibly powerful and they change your entire outlook about how what life is all about. That's what we mean by insight. It really changes things upside down. That's why it's so interesting here. So the Buddha is perfect in true knowledge and conduct. And this is the other thing which is interesting here. We were talking before about the idea that when you see a teacher, a Buddha, or whoever it is, you should look at them and you should see if their conduct is appropriate, right? And this is one of the things about the Buddha which is so good about somebody being fully awakened. That experience of full awakening is not just a psychological thing that has an internal consequence, it also has external consequences. You become externally different. It has an effect on your conduct, right? So sometimes you hear about crazy wisdom. You heard about the word crazy wisdom. Now, as far as I understand the suttas, either you are crazy or you are wise. You cannot be both at the same time. If you are crazy, you're not wise. If you're wise, you're not crazy. And this is what this means here, right? Your conduct is also affected by your wisdom. You don't act like a crazy person when you have the real insight. It changes you. If you have no defilements of the mind, if all you have inside is metta and compassion for other beings, that's going to come out in the way you speak and the way you act. It's going to be visible outside. And that is why the Buddha says that we should observe someone and to see whether they are worthy of our respect or not. So this is a very important point, that conduct and wisdom go together here. Right? The Buddha says elsewhere in the suttas, as I speak, so I act, as I act, so I speak. There is integrity there in how the Buddha lives his life, and any arahant will live their life. So, perfect in true knowledge and conduct. Sublime. The word for sublime is sugata in Pali, one of the famous epithets of the Buddha. And sugata means something like well gone. Gata, past participle, for those of you Pali students here. Gata, past participle of the word gacchati, which means to go. It means gone. And su is like good or well. So literally means well gone. And it is closely related to some of the other words that we see in Pali. Sometimes sugati means someone has gone to a good destination, right? A good rebirth. Dugati is gone to a bad destination. It's related to all of that. So Sugata really means somebody who in this life has gone to a good destination, have achieved happiness in this life. Well gone. The happy one, you could say. But happy one sounds a bit bland. It's really, really happy one. All suffering gone. The highest kind of happiness attainable as a human being. So that's what sublime really means. It's not so obvious what sublime means, but that's actually what it comes down to. Knower of the world. It says here, knower of worlds. That would say knower of the worlds is a perhaps better. Loka vidu is the Pali word, right? When you do the Itipiso chant. And this means a number of things depending on how you want to approach this idea. And of course, normally it is said to mean the fact that you know all the different planes of existence. Beings live in this plane. You have the, it's called the Kama Vachara or Kama Loka, which is the world of sensuality, which has, I don't know how many planes, 11 plane, something like that. And then you have above that, you have the Rupa Vachara or Rupa Loka, which is the planes of Samadhi and Jhanas, which has a large number of planes in it. And then you have the Arupa Loka or Arupa Avachara above that again. 31 planes of existence. And you know all that and you understand the Kamma that leads to these realms and all of these kind of things. And that is kind of fair enough in a way, but I'm not always sure how useful it is to know that kind of thing. It's kind of okay, but I'm not sure if it is really kind of has an immediate effect on how we understand the Buddha. To me, the idea of Loka Vidu, the thing that really matters, is the understanding of happiness and suffering in the world. This is what makes the Buddha special. This is why he has something to teach us that is really interesting. In the fact that he understands happiness and suffering, not only in the human life, but any potential happiness and suffering that is possible to have in samsaric existence. Any kind of rebirth, any kind of existence, from the lowest to the highest. And of course, the only way that you are going to be able to make a decision about whether it is good to be reborn, good to keep on running around in samsara, whether it's good to be in this rebirth or that rebirth, the only way you can really make a decision on that, whether enlightenment is good or bad, is to understand happiness and suffering in all its potential. When you understand happiness and suffering completely, from the highest happiness to the most worst kind of suffering, and you understand whether it's permanent or impermanent, when you understand all of that, then you can make a decision whether it is worthwhile kind of keeping on going round and round, or whether we have to get out of this mess, right? And this is what the Buddha really means when we talk about the Buddha understanding the world. And one way of thinking about this, one of the things that people often find difficult is to understand the idea of different rebirths. What does it mean to be reborn as a deva? Right, sounds kind of cool, right? You get big mansions, a lot of happiness and all this kind of stuff. Sounds nice to be a deva. What is it like to be reborn as a ghost? Oh, that doesn't sound so good, right? Really miserable, always hungry. The traditional way of depicting a ghost, a big belly but small mouth, right? Always hungry but can't get anything into your mouth because the mouth is too small. This is one of the way, the hungry ghosts. Anyway, a lot of suffering there. So one way of understanding all of this is just to look at the human realm. The human realm you have from the kind of the highest happiness in the human realm, people who are really wealthy, well-educated, intelligent, coming from a good family, having all the things that are good in this world, right? And there are some people, and they're happy as well, right? And when they meditate, for goodness sake, they even get good meditation at the same time, right? This is what happens to some people. It's really unfair that some people get everything and other people will be kind of more ordinary. And then you have people in this world who are really miserable, right? People are born into poverty, into war zone, who are stupid, who have no education. They have absolutely nothing. And when they meditate, they're miserable as well. So, and it is a bit like that. You have, so even in the human realm, there's actually quite a lot of variety here. And then there are most people who are somewhere in the middle here. So when we look at samsara, All we are really doing is, instead of the human realm being happy from here and suffering to there, we stretch this out, right? So the happiness goes higher and higher and higher and higher. So it's just an expansion of what we already see in the human realm. And also the suffering side as well is expanded going downwards to far, far more suffering than the worst kind of suffering you can have as a human being here. So this is what it is. It's just taking the human realm, happiness, suffering, and expanding it out. And that's really what it is. And that only when you have that full understanding of all the potential happiness and suffering have you really understood what the world is like. So remember, if you get reborn as a deva, what does it feel like? Well, what it feels like is just you. You are there, right? It's like in this life, one day perhaps you start off in life in a certain way. Maybe you start off in a poor family and you build yourself up and you become quite wealthy. Well, the difference between that when you were poor to when you're wealthy, that's what it's like when you kind of go from the human realm to the deva realm. It's still, you are still there. You are still there. It's still me, right? And then you are in the deva loka. You have more happiness. Or you get reborn in the ghost realm. It's still you who are there. It still feels like you. But now you have more suffering. It's not some kind of transformation that suddenly you become something completely different. Psychologically, it is still the same, roughly the same being. Nothing is permanent, of course, but roughly the same being with the same tendencies, the same habits that moves on into these realms. Nothing very mysterious about these things at all. It's very natural in many ways, but we need to think about them in the right way here. So this is what the Buddha has discovered. Everything there is about happiness and suffering in its fullest extent, and that is why he has the ability to teach us about happiness and suffering, right? Because he knows what is there, what is at stake, what the problems are. You weigh it all up and you realize actually it is quite terrible. Altogether, when you look at the whole thing, it really isn't worthwhile. That is what the Buddha says. Especially that becomes true when you understand things like non-self. That is really one of the crucial things to understand. Then it is much easier to see what suffering is. The problem with the sense of self is that as long as you feel that there is a self there, you have a vested interest in these five khandhas. The five khandhas will have a certain importance to you. They are mine, right? And when something is yours, you are blinded by reality. You cannot see things as they actually are. When you take away that vested interest and you see things in a non-self way, only then is it possible to see suffering for what it actually is. You can see the five khandhas for what they are in a dispassionate way without being attached to these things. This is why the understanding non-self is so crucial, because it gives an ability to see things more clearly. So anyway, knower of the world, incomparable leader of persons to be tamed, or if you like, incomparable leader of tameable people. So the question is, are you tameable? That's the question, right? This is really the important thing. We have to be tameable. The fact that you are here is a good start, right? The fact that I'm here is also a good start, because that means that there is some chance. But there are many people in the world who are not interested in the Buddha's teachings, who think it's a waste of time. You try to tell them and they say, oh, don't bother me with that. I've got more important things to do, like making money or whatever it is, right? And of course, if you have no interest, if you are inclined in the wrong direction, if you have very strong views that take you in a different way, it is very difficult. You are not really tameable, because you can't even get you started. And this is part of the problem. Or you are really stupid, right? And you can't even think clearly about things. Or you are, whatever it is, there are all these possibilities. Or you are born at the time when there is no Buddhist teachings and all these kind of things. Then there is very little hope. And you are not really tameable. So we have to make ourselves as tameable as possible. And tameable really just means what makes us not tame is, again, the same old defilements. When the defilements are in charge, we are the slave of those defilements, right? And we are running around after them, restless, agitated. Restless and agitation is the opposite of being tamed. Tamed means peaceful and calm, and not being bullied, literally bullied, right? Bullied by these defilements, this way and that way, and all of that kind of thing here. So that is the idea of taming in Buddhism, means taming the defilements. So the Buddha is the incomparable leader, Anuttaro Purisadhammasarati. So incomparable here, he's kind of the top, because precisely because he has understood happiness and suffering fully, he becomes incomparable as a teacher. He has the understanding, right? He has the wisdom. He knows what people actually need. He knows what every one of us actually wants. What is it that we want? We want to be happy. We want to be away from suffering. And yet the problem in life is that even though we want those things, so often we do things the wrong way. We don't understand where these things are. So we actually get suffering rather than happiness, even though what we want in life really is happiness. Right, it's one of those very deep-seated things and very kind of problematic things. And almost, it makes you have compassion for almost everyone straight away. The knowledge that everybody wants to be happy, but we don't know where it is. We can't find it. We're kind of fumbling around in the dark, going in the wrong direction, creating suffering for ourselves, when what we really want is happiness. It's kind of tragic, isn't it? How can we not have compassion for both ourselves and everyone when we see that this is actually what is going on? We are just heading off in the wrong way here. And it's a beautiful way of actually giving rise to compassion for all beings in this world when you see that we do things that we try, that we think are going to give us happiness, but actually they never actually do. It's a kind of tragedy. It's like one of those Greek tragedies. The Greeks always wrote these very tragic things, and this is a bit like that. We're all kind of part of this Greek tragedy in a way here. And so the Buddha comes. He has this understanding. He realizes that he has understood that very thing which everyone really is seeking for. Right, he understands. I have the goods. I know what the world is like. Everybody wants this, and because he knows that he has what everybody wants, then of course compassion arises in the Buddha for the world, and it is this compassion that arises in him that becomes the driving force for his teaching career when he teaches people for 45 years. And this is what is so powerful about the Buddha, the fact that he has these two things. He has the wisdom, the highest insight into happiness and suffering, what everybody in the world wants, right? That is what we mean by wisdom in Buddhism. Anyone who is wise, we consider wise in our life, is somebody who has the ability to help us with our problems and help us out and move us towards happiness. The Buddha has that more than anyone else. The second thing the Buddha has, he has the compassion, the understanding that he is able to help people if they are willing to listen. This is why we often talk about the combination of wisdom and compassion in the Buddha. And as I was saying the other day, what is so powerful about this is that when the Buddha teaches us, he has no vested interest. By vested interest, I mean there's nothing in it for him, right? He doesn't care if we kind of bow down to him or respect to him. Well, it's kind of, I guess he cares in the sense that if we don't do it, he may not even bother teaching us, but at least if we have respect and we show that we are willing to listen. But he doesn't have anything, he doesn't kind of gain anything from that. In fact, he only loses from the fact that he has to teach. For the Buddha, far better to meditate and just sit in the cave and get into the jhanas, right? And the bliss of the highest kind of meditative states that you can have. Much better for the Buddha. But because of compassion, he actually goes out to teach instead. The vast majority of teachers in the world, they teach because there is something in it for the teacher. Either they get a salary, right? Or they get somebody to kind of, maybe if you are a spiritual teacher, somebody to respect them. You get power over people, right? Maybe if you are a dodgy kind of teacher. Usually there is something in it for the teacher. And as long as there is something in it for the teacher, it's not coming from complete purity. Right is very easy if you think that you're going to get lots of donation at the end of the retreat. Maybe you say something to please the retreatants, right? Instead of giving them the pure Dhamma, because you know that there is some benefit to be had maybe if you do things in the right way. And this is what is so beautiful about the Buddha. There is no benefit to be had for the Buddha. Everything he says comes from complete purity. Purely just from compassion and nothing else. And this means that the sayings of the Buddha, whatever he teaches, it means you can trust it 100%. It is not there to gain anything. It's there purely for compassion, purely out of kindness, to help us get out of suffering. And this is means that when you read the suttas and when you listen to the word of the Buddha, it means that you read it with more care. You read it with more open mind, because you know that this is actually just for your own benefit and for no other reason whatsoever. And even if there is a passage that you might find difficult, you might feel, oh, but Buddha, you're asking too much. I'm not sure if I can do this, right? And this is sometimes what it feels like when you read the suttas. Oh, this is going too far. Still, you, at the very least, you listen and you try to understand if you possibly can, and you allow it to mature over a long period of time, and then if you're able to take it in over a long period of time, you take it seriously because you know it's coming from a very beautiful and pure place inside. And this is one of the things I find so powerful about this. The Buddha comes from complete purity in giving these teachings. This is what makes him so special, right? This is what makes him the unsurpassed teacher, someone who is extraordinarily rare in this world, and you don't find people like this very often at all. That is the unsurpassed teacher of tameable people. One of the things, one of the ways that I sometimes like to think about the Buddha, I try to always to think about ways to think about the Buddha, and one of the ways I like to think of him is I try to kind of put myself into India 2,500 years ago, and very often the Buddha would sit at the foot of a tree somewhere, right, sitting at the root, and you can imagine yourself being there in India 2,500 years ago, and you see this man, right, at the root, sitting at the root of a tree, and he looks quite ordinary. He's not 6 meters tall, he doesn't fly through the air, anything like that. He sits at the root of a tree, very, very peacefully. And there's something very attractive about this person, something that attracts you, something very peaceful, something very sublime, something very special. But in general, he looks quite ordinary. You can't tell from the outside, really, that there's something very special going on. So you go over to this person because you feel somehow attracted to this. You get the feeling that there's some kind of spiritual depth, some kind of spiritual profundity about this person. You go over there and maybe you bow down because you have respect for people who are monastics. He's wearing a robe, right? He looks a little bit like a monk today, but also a little bit different because the robes at that time probably were a little bit different from what monks, monastics wear now. And then you sit down and you start to listen to the Buddha, and then you start, and what the things that you hear are very simple things, right? Basic things, but they're coming from a place of great purity, of great compassion, of great kindness, and of course great peace as well. But he will tell you simple things like, just be kind, be compassionate in the world, do the right thing, the sort of things that we can read about in the suttas. But there's something about the way he says that which gives you incredible confidence and trust that what is going on is true, and it is only for your benefit and for no other reason whatsoever. So this is the Buddha, right? An ordinary human being. One of us, not somebody who is very special, at least on the outside. But of course, on the inside, the mind of the Buddha is quite remarkable in many ways, and quite different from the mind of most of us, because it has been transformed through his meditation practice, through the profound insights we have been just talking about. And some of the things that you sometimes read in the suttas can be really mind-blowing. And I remember one of the things that we'll actually have a look at that later on is the Buddha's understanding of the universe. Right? And you think, how can a man sitting there at the root of a tree in ancient India know all of these things about the universe? Right? Imagine closing your eyes and suddenly the universe just opens up and you see everything. And then you can tell everybody about galaxies, about solar system, all these kind of things. But it seems that the Buddha actually knew about these things. And of course, the only way that you can really explain that is because he looked into his past lives and he actually saw how the universe worked in the past. And because he saw that, he knows that is how the universe works also now. That is the most likely way to explain that. So quite astonishing, this simple, ordinary person, but at the same time, somebody who is worthy of the highest kind of respect because they have really understood life to its fullest and final conclusion, what it is all about. Oh, okay, time is already up, actually. Okay, so we will stop there. And we will come back again at 3:15. I'll see you again 3:15 here.